Week two. Okay, let's summarize week one as best we can. What have we talked about so far? Let's get a running start at this week so that I can remember what we talked about.
Kingdom.
There's the Sunday school answer. We have been talking about kingdom. What about kingdom? We had four classes already, and we talked a lot about it. We're going to have, I think, 50-something more, and we're going to talk a lot more about it. But what do we talk about so far?
The expectations of the kingdom of the Messiah.
The expectations of the kingdom of the Messiah. Exactly what?
Matthew wrote his book in the lens of kingdom.
Matthew seems to be really emphasizing kingdom throughout his book, does he not? From the very first verse, he's saying something is beginning, something is dawning, it is brand new, and it involves a king and a kingdom, specifically Jesus as the Jewish Messiah. What else?
Set up of the Jewish kingdom, how it was before.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly, especially the genealogy. The genealogy talks about, you know, how it establishes the kingdom, and then the second part says how the kingdom was lost, and then now we're going to be talking about how the kingdom is restored, and Jesus plays an important part of that. Exactly. What else?
The genealogy of Jesus.
Yeah, the genealogy of Jesus. And what does it emphasize? What character in particular, outside of Jesus? Yeah, it sure is. Matter of fact, it calls him what, David? King David, in verse 6, I think it is. What else?
Talked a little bit about Joseph and Mary and how all that.
Yeah, Joseph and Mary and how that all took place, why they were where they were, where they were headed, and why that was happening, right? The betrothal period and how it would have been necessary for him to divorce her. Because had she been impregnated by somebody else, which would be the logical conclusion, barring a miracle, which we'll find out that that is what happened, she would have been committing adultery because it was a legally binding contract whenever you're in a betrothal situation. Yeah? I thought I saw a hand over here.
I was just going to say, like, the marriage.
Yeah. The way in which it came about with the bridegroom gift and the bride's gift and the dowry and all that stuff. Exactly. Say it again.
Sorry.
You're good, bro.
Rejection, it's God as their king.
Yeah, Israel rejected God as their king, specifically two separate times. Can we remember both times in the Old Testament? 2 Samuel 8. Whoa, is that right? 1 Samuel 8, yeah. That's all right, I was thinking 2 Samuel 23, but no, 1 Samuel 8, that's the first second rejection. Where's the first one? The fall of man. Genesis chapter 3, right? And those were both right at the beginning of whenever you have the messianic language starting to emerge. Genesis 3:15 the first time, 2 Samuel 23 the second time, where we really see the messianic language developing. Because usually when there's a rejection of God, there's also grace embedded in it. And that grace is defined by the Messiah, the kingdom. Anything else? Yes. Yes. And that segues wonderfully into what we're going to be talking about right off the bat this morning. Jesus is the fulfillment of the law and the prophets. This is what Matthew is hammering on. Hammering on, and he does it through what we have up here. What we have up here is, you will see it 12 times, and I've circled one that people somewhat debate about. 12 times a fulfillment formula. And what you will have is in Matthew, it'll say, as it was written in the prophets, or as the prophet Isaiah said, or as Jeremiah. This formula-like statement that's a fulfillment formula. This was done in order to fulfill what was said in the prophets. You've heard what I'm talking about. You've read through Matthew once, right? This happens how many times? Count them. Counting the one that is debated, how many times? Huh! Is that significant? 12. Yeah, how many disciples will Jesus grab a hold of? Is that an accident? No. Numbers, especially in Jewish literature, numbers are very rarely an accident. And they very rarely are focusing on accuracy. Most of the time, Jews are focusing on what? Symbolism. They're using numbers to talk about something that's bigger than the number itself. 12 times that there is a somewhat of a fulfillment formula in Matthew is not an accident. The one that is debated, the reason why it's debated, is because Jesus uses the formula, but he does not attach it to a quote. The rest of them all have a quote in close proximity. They're introducing a quote. Jesus does not use a quote, and yet he uses the same formula. That's why I think that 12 is legitimate. Okay? There's something else, though. There are 56 quotes of the Old Testament in the book of Matthew, 12 of which stand out as significant. Not that the rest of them are insignificant, but 12 of which really hammer home this concept that what God wanted accomplished in Israel is now applied to Christ. 12 of them, how do I do that on my fingers? 12 of them. 12 of them focus on what God wanted to accomplish in Israel, but that they did not accomplish. But Christ now is accomplishing it. Now notice the way this is broken down. Now, those of you that are looking at this, I apologize for the confusion of it. These seven I'm talking about as separate from these five. And the only reason why I wrote them up there is so that they could see it. So, these seven, notice where these are located. Every one of them. Notice where they're located. What is significant about these seven? Where are they all located? Say it again. Oh, yes, yes. I'm sorry. Not the Old Testament correlation. That is true. The prophets, very, very good observation. But where in Matthew are they located? Yeah. Before the Sermon on the Mount. Before what else? Before what? Before his public ministry, before the first major shift. Chapter 4, verse 17, where Jesus speaks in public for the very first time in the book of Matthew. And he says what? Repent for what? The kingdom of heaven is near. 4:17 is the first time he does that. Seven times. This concept of what God wanted accomplished in Israel is applied to Christ in the first four chapters before the public ministry launches. Which means there are five times in which Matthew does this after his public ministry begins. Now notice where these are located in Matthew. What is significant about their location? I'll give you a hint. These are really important. Yeah. Every single one of the discourses and the sections that follow contains another one of these particular quotations. You following me? So you have this quotation right here, which is in the chunk of the Sermon on the Mount, which is the Sermon on the Mount and what follows. Right here you have the Sermon of Mission and what follows. That's where this one occurs. Right here you have inside of the Sermon of the Parable of the Kingdoms and what follows this one. Then right here you have what happens on the Sermon of the Church Community in chapter 18 and what follows. And right here you have the Sermon of the Olivet Discourse and what follows. Every one of the major chunks has another one of these fulfillment language. What is he saying by this whole makeup? Think big picture here. Sometimes we focus too much on just the individual and we don't look at the big structure of what he's developing. What is he developing? It plays off what Brianna was just saying a minute ago.
He's linking himself to the prophets.
Yeah.
And to the law.
He is the fulfillment of everything. He does pull from the prophets, but he pulls from the prophets in 12 specific ways to point to accomplishment of what Israel was supposed to accomplish, but what they failed. Now Jesus succeeds. You see what's happening? Sometimes you really got to pull back from the book of Matthew and look at the whole structure, because he's developing something that's very Jewish but is very important. Fulfillment language is huge. And the first time we hit one of these fulfillment language stuff is where we left off last class, which is in verse 22. But we're going to start in verse 18 and run up to 22 so we know where we're at. This is how the birth, the genesis of Jesus Christ, came about. His mother Mary was pledged to be married to Joseph. But before they came together, she was found to be pregnant with child through the Holy Spirit. Because Joseph, her husband, was a righteous man and did not want to expose her to public disgrace, he had in mind to divorce her quietly. But after he had considered this, an angel of the Lord appeared to him in a dream and said, "Joseph, son of David, do not be afraid to take Mary home as your wife, because what is conceived in her is from the Holy Spirit. She will give birth to a son, and you are to give him the name Jesus, because he will save his people from their sins." All this took place to fulfill what the Lord had said to the prophet. Do you hear the fulfillment formula? Holler if you hear me. Okay, good. Thank you. All this took place to fulfill what the Lord had said to the prophet. The virgin will be with child and will give birth to a son, and they will call him Emmanuel, which means God with us. Now, what is the major dilemma about this particular fulfillment passage? Does anyone know? If you read your commentary, there could be an... Yes?
Is it the word virgin?
The word virgin. What is the issue around the word virgin there, Mr. Williamson?
That's not really the word in Hebrew.
In the Hebrew, it's a different... It's an interesting... Well, this is what happens here. In Hebrew, it's the word ha'alma, which usually, matter of fact, 99% of the time, is not really talking about virginity. It's talking about the age of the woman, saying she's young. She's really young. Now, are there times when it is connected to virginity? Yes. There are times when it is. But is that the primary emphasis? No, it's not. The primary emphasis of the word ha'alma in Hebrew is not virgin. However, this text is not following the Hebrew. This text is following what? The Septuagint, which uses which word, Greek scholars? Shout it out. Be proud. If you don't know it, learn it. This is an important word. There's a major debate around this. Parthenos. Virgin. See, the Septuagint's much more specific. The word Parthenos is very much attached to virginity. Now, is it always referring to a virgin? Not always. Sometimes it's connected to simply just a young lady of a virgin-like age. However, 90% of the time, Parthenos is referring to a virgin. So what you have here is you have two distinct traditions. And Matthew has a choice. Well, first, before we get to that, let's ask an important question at Ozark Christian College, which would be what? About the Old Testament text. What do I want to ask first? What is the context of Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14? Does anybody know? Or do you just know it out of context, like Matthew uses it here? Oh!
Is it talking about, like, Isaiah's son?
No, but it is involving Isaiah. Isaiah is speaking this is Isaiah speaking to, anybody know what person? Give you a hint, he's a king.
Ahaz.
King Ahaz, who was the king of which one of the separated kingdoms? You know, it's a 50-50 chance here. Judah, the southern kingdom, which is what Jesus' genealogy was tracing, remember? In 734, Ahaz is freaking out. Ahaz, he's the king of Judah over the southern kingdom, and he's freaking out because the northern kingdom has made an alliance with Syria. The northern kingdom's king's name was Pekah, and he had made an alliance with Rezin of Syria. And they were going to come down and destroy the southern kingdom, take good old Ahaz off the throne, and put a guy on there by the name of Tabeel. And the reason why they wanted Tabeel was a simple political reason. They wanted a puppet in the southern kingdom that they could control. So Ahaz was freaking out. He's like, oh, you know, my days are over. It's you know, God's going to be abandoning us. Why is this happening? Isaiah comes to him and he says, relax, Ahaz. Chill out. God is not going to violate his promise that he had to David. It's not going to happen. What promise to David? What is he talking about? Yeah. 2 Samuel chapter, 7, verse 23. That his kingdom would last forever. He says he's not going to violate that. Chill out. He says, matter of fact, here's going to be the sign. This young girl over here, which I believe that Ahaz knew which young maiden it was, but we don't know. We don't know. There are people that argue for Hezekiah, some for Mahershala Hashbaz. I always say that name wrong. Mahershala Hashbaz. That's a cool name to say. Learn it. It's fun. But we don't know exactly who it was. Ahaz knew, though. And he says, this young maiden, whenever she has a child, that will be a sign from God that you will know. You will know that he will not abandon his promise. Matter of fact, this is what's interesting. 734 is when this oracle is probably given. We know that in 732, 2 years later, 2 years later, that the Northern Alliance was destroyed because Tiglath-Pileser III from Assyria kills Rezin. He destroys the Syrian king. So here's what happens. 734, Ahaz is freaking out. 732, the Northern Alliance is broken. That means there's about 2 years from whenever this oracle was pronounced in 714. Well, in Isaiah 714. And whenever it came to fruition 2 years later. Are you tracking with me? Some of you look very quizzical. Let me write this down so you can see what I'm saying. 734 BC, what was significant about this? This is where Ahaz is freaking out, right? Following me? Why is he freaking out? Say it again. Yeah, the northern kingdom, Israel, is wanting to attack his kingdom and take him off the throne. And what does Isaiah do? Exactly. Don't freak out, because God's going to do what? Keep his promise to David. And how is he going to show this? By having the Ha'alma have a baby, a young maiden. If we know in 732 is whenever the northern kingdom was destroyed, this is what we know could have happened in this 2 years. That a young maiden who was of age to be married but was not married yet could have been betrothed, married, and had a baby. All in that time period, right? Betrothals usually lasted how long? A year. Marriage ceremony happens, she gets pregnant. 9 months later, bam, she has a kid. So what would be significant about it is this. He looks over and sees this young maiden who's not even betrothed yet. And Isaiah says, she will give birth to a child. And you will know then that God is keeping his promise. Ahaz has assurance, but it's not from a miraculous event in Ahaz's time period. In Ahaz's time period, the oracle is pointing to a duration of time in which he can understand that the promise of God will be upkept. Does he follow me? In the original context, I do not believe he was talking about a literal virgin that was miraculously going to be giving a birth. You following me? But Matthew takes it and does what? What does he do? Well, technically he takes it out of context. Kind of. He kind of does a Jewish how much greater than. Because we know for the fact that Parthenos was used in the Septuagint that there was a Jewish tradition that this oracle was not totally fulfilled. And the reason for that is the context of the passage. Because when you're tracing the discussion of this child from chapter 7 to chapter 9, all of a sudden the language starts to get a little weird. In chapter 9, verse 6, this child is described by some pretty big names like Wonderful Counselor, Almighty God, the Prince of Peace. Isaiah chapter 9, verse 6, he says, this child, that this woman will be the deliverer of everyone. God's representative on earth. And so, Parthenos became a tradition because some believe that this probably was not fulfilled in totality. Matthew grabs that tradition, brings it into his gospel and says, yeah, as a matter of fact, there's even a bigger story going on here. And it's much more miraculous than what Ahaz ever had before him, because this was a literal virgin, Parthenos, who gave birth to a child who will actually be the Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God. Does this make sense? Did he take it out of context? Kind of. And you need to be okay with that. Because you are not here to worship the historical grammatical method. Although I think it is the most effective thing I know how to do, there are things that, you know what, probably we should explore in a little bit more totality. Let that sink in. But you need to be able to do it appropriately. And right now, let's just say we can't. Any questions about that? Yeah.
I was noticing that, I don't know if this is significant at all, but the year 734 adds up to 14, and the child is like fulfilling the promise of David, and it's also used of Jesus. That basically is all our Jesus step
46. I mean, it's possible. I think I would fall more towards that if like David somehow referenced the date. Or, I mean, not David, Matthew, I'm sorry. Referenced the date. I think that's intriguing. My only hesitation to that is too, is I'm sort of thinking like, well, what happens if it's actually like 735, but we estimate 734? I don't know. It's possible. I wouldn't look too far into that. Any other questions or observations? Matthew takes this and he says something bigger is happening. But here's the key link between both events. Because some of you may be thinking, why in the world did he just grab this event out of the air? The key link is this. In both of them, the kingdom of God is being threatened to be totally destroyed. And the promise of both children was that God will intervene to keep his promises of restoration and of deliverance. So both of them have a major parallel in the life of Israel. But in Jesus, the ultimate fulfillment comes. You see how those come together eventually? Even though they're probably two separate events, Matthew's bringing them together because they all carry one same point. The deliverance of God through his divine intervention to bring about restoration to his kingdom. Yeah?
During that year, the 734, were the years even created? Were those numbers created at that time?
Not the number 734, no. No, that's another good point to bring up. Yeah. Matter of fact, I got answers to some of the questions that were given, and I forgot it in my office. Somebody asked about the reference for the good grief. The inscription that I gave last time and the book I have that it's in there, it's in my office, I left it. But I also looked up and in the 6th century is whenever the BC AD thing began. 325, the Council of Nicaea, is whenever the church adopted the Julio-Claudian calendar, and a monk by the name of Dionysius, which is an ironic name in and of itself, in the 6th century is the one that then brought it back to Jesus' birth at 0 AD BC, even though he got it wrong ultimately. So that was the question that was asked last week, and I looked it up, I promised. Okay, let's keep reading. The virgin will be with child, and she will give birth to a son, and they will call him Emmanuel. Which means, now this is not in Isaiah 7:14, the interpretation of the name. Which means, God with us. This is intriguing to me, because the book of Matthew was bookended by this name, by this concept, God with us. Matter of fact, Matthew chapter 28, verse 20 says what? Cheat if you have to. Says what?
I will be with you.
I will be with you always, even to the end of the age. Who is speaking?
Jesus.
God with us. The beginning of the book starts off saying, Emmanuel, God with us. He will be with us. Is the same way the book ends. Jesus saying, I will be with you always. And who is he with us? God with us. Emmanuel. When Joseph woke up, he did what the angel of the Lord had commanded him and took Mary home as his wife. But he had no union with her until she gave birth to a son. It is possible that little word until, possible, does infer that they had sexual relations after Jesus was born. But it does not mandate that. Does that make sense? The Catholics will say that there was perpetual virginity for Mary, which is actually very complex. It's not just them being idiots. They have reasons for that. It kind of, in some sense, attaches into original sin. We don't have time to go into it. But her perpetual virginity is actually protecting the holiness of Jesus because of the way they look at sex, to be honest with you. And just look at their priest and nun rules if you don't have a clear idea of what they think of sex. But I will not say that you can argue really definitively that the word until mandates that they did have sex because the word until is still somewhat ambiguous. Does that make sense? Yeah?
Didn't Jesus have brothers though?
Oh yeah. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying there's not other arguments.
Okay, I was just
what I am saying is that don't make this one your primary one. Oh yeah. But what they do is they look at the word Adelphoi and they say that means cousins. Even though that's never happened in the history of the Adelphoi language, so whatever. but it's not like they're morons. You have to understand, every mandate in the Catholic Church that they make, even though we might disagree with it, it's attached to a bigger issue. And so to call the entire issue stupid is to simply overlook what they're doing. You need to be more studied up on what they're protecting as opposed to what they're doing. Does that make sense? Don't just call them. There's a lot of brilliant, more brilliant Catholics than what we have Protestants, because simply there's more of them. But she had no union with her until she gave birth to her son. Oh, and he gave him the name Jesus. So we see the obedience and the righteousness of Joseph coming through. We have to... Oh, good grief. Who's texting me at 7 in the morning? I was trying to look at what time it is. Okay, we are not getting anywhere. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem. We need to stop there because there's a lot of stuff packed in this first verse. Number one, after Jesus was born, in that phrase, what happens? Yeah! We skip like all the good stuff. We don't get to see that there's no room in an inn. We don't get to see the shepherds coming. We don't get to see any of that in Matthew. That all happens in Luke. We don't have any of that. As a matter of fact, in that phrase, we jump 2 years. We don't even get to see the birth. Kind of we do, after she was given birth. Just like breezes through it. We don't get to see all the cool stuff that you usually see on the Christmas, the Christmas pageants. You don't get to see any of it. It immediately jumps 2 years. And how do I know it's 2 years? Well, there's two reasons for that. Number one, in verse 8 and verse 10, it uses the word child that is very much different than the word baby or infant. Second, in verse, 11? Yes. In verse 11, he's in a house and not a manger. He's not in the manger now. They're in a house in Bethlehem. Matter of fact, if that makes sense, if you're connecting the dots here, that means Jesus lived in Bethlehem for the first couple years of his life. Then, where does he go after Bethlehem? Egypt. And he ultimately lands where? Nazareth. So in this little phrase, we skip all the stuff we normally have at Christmas. Also, what is significant here is the word Bethlehem. Why is that important? Why is he re-emphasizing Bethlehem? That's where David was born, and where was David also? What happened significantly in David's life there? He was anointed the king in Bethlehem. That parallel will continue throughout this rest of this chapter. Jesus is both born in Bethlehem, which by the way is called the city of David. Both born in Bethlehem, and he will be anointed king there in just a minute by Gentiles. Yes?
I'm just curious. We know from Luke that they went to Bethlehem for like the census. Mm-hmm. So why would they do any idea why they stayed there? And especially since they went on it, we know that they also went on into Jerusalem to have it circumcised, all that stuff in the temple. So,
I can give you my theory. My theory is it's simply a matter of the fact that they're a peasant family and they can't just move at a whim. So whenever they went for the census in Bethlehem, having probably ancestors there since he is from the lineage of David, still living in Bethlehem, they probably just found family there and decided to stay there because moving back and forth would just not have made much sense. So more than likely it was strictly economic. But then whenever Israel, matter of fact, I think that the way that they had money to go to Egypt was that they were able to sell the gifts that the Magi gave them, which made it economically possible for them to have flight, God provided, through Gentiles to help them escape. Yeah. Yes?
Keener talks about in the commentary how he said that Joseph had money, had a substantial amount of money or something like that, and then the Roman taxes were so big that
he lost
all of his money and they had to stay in Bethlehem.
Yeah, I could buy that as well. It's definitely a possibility. I mean, to be able to say a substantial amount of money, I think is to overstate it. Because it's not like the census was the first time they were being hit with a Roman tax. I mean, the Roman tribute has been around since 40, whenever... Well, matter of fact, we'll talk about this in a second. Well, we can even move into this now. When Herod was in power, the taxes were off the charts. Not just because of the Roman tribute, but because Herod was this incredible builder. I mean, he was building entire cities on the seashore line by clearing out and making new enclaves within the city, the sea itself. I mean, Herod was a magnificent builder. He was pouring loads of money into reconstructing the temple way better than the grandeur of even Solomon. But where is Herod getting the money to do this? The people of Israel. So the taxes, I don't think I could argue at any point that Joseph would have had a substantial amount of money, because the taxes themselves would have been over 50 to 60% of what he was making. Because I'm not even, with the Roman tribute, the Herod taxes, I'm not even talking about the temple taxes. The temple tithes, even though the word tithe is not good there, because usually the temple tithe of the Old Testament, if they were still keeping it in the first century time, it would have been 23.5%. It's not just 10. So, I mean, if you add all that up, I don't know how he could have accumulated much wealth at all. He would have had the money to get to Bethlehem, but he would not have had the money. Even because the census in and of itself, why it would have maybe cost some more money, the primary thing was to number the amount of people, which usually a kingdom would do to show who was sovereign over the people that they numbered. So I don't know where Keener could argue. The only way that you can argue that there was some sort of money, well, but this is even later, this is in Nazareth, is that Sepphoris, which was a big city up near Nazareth, probably about maybe 10 to 15 miles away from Nazareth, would have been rebuilt at the time Jesus would have been growing up. And so carpenters were in high demand, which is probably why Nazareth was a good location for also for them to locate, because there would have been work right next to their city. But it would have still been a Jewish city, so they would have been kosher. That was a long tirade for not really much of a purpose, but anyway.
Would it also be because of the shame of going back home that Mary was pregnant before they were actually married?
Possibly, but he had family in Bethlehem, so the shame would have been already renowned. Matter of fact, we know even in Nazareth that the shame followed them, because whenever Jesus is older, they basically pointed out in John chapter 9, wait a minute, this guy doesn't even have a father. You know, the technical name, even though people snicker at this, is he was a bastard. He was a bastard. He was fatherless. And that was even following them up in Nazareth. So to say that the shame was in some sense mitigated by going to Bethlehem would probably be overstated, because if it made it from Egypt up to Nazareth, it was probably attached to like the Scarlet Letter, if you've ever read that book. Yeah?
What was the gifts as far as in the wedding? Could you have had a little bit of money for the wedding stuff?
Possibly. That may have been even the money from which they used in order to get down to Bethlehem. Yeah, absolutely. But then again, if they both come from peasant families, it wouldn't have been a doozy amount of money. But yeah, that's a good point. They had to have had income at some point to get down to Bethlehem. What did they use? Possibly the dowry, possibly money that he made through his carpentry business. We don't know where the money came from, but we do know that he was not rich. The taxes wouldn't have allowed it, and his occupation wasn't that high demand until a couple years later. Yeah, good questions. Okay, let's keep moving. Let's just kind of breeze through King Herod. I just want you to get an idea of King Herod. King Herod was not a Jew. He was born an Idumean. He was a foreigner that was ruling over them, which would have caused Jews some problems, right? Eh? Yes? No? Would that not have caused some problems? Yes! Why? Yes, that means that they're still in exile under the rule of a foreign king. He was the puppet of Rome. He was the puppet of Rome, a client king. He got this position in 40 BC whenever he, thievery is what comes to mind, schemed his way into the position of ruler over the area. Actually, he ends up splitting up his kingdom amongst his four sons eventually, because he had quite a little bit of a kingdom. I won't read you Josephus, but Josephus taught... Well, no, I will read it, because it describes his paranoia. Herod was a psycho. He was absolutely paranoid, because the way in which he got his kingdom was so illegitimate, he was expecting the same thing to happen to him from someone else. So Herod says, or Josephus says in Antiquities 15, he says, Herod disallowed public gatherings, groups walking about, or normal community life. He disallowed it. And all activity was watched. The punishment given to those caught were harsh, and both openly and secretly many were brought to the fortress Hyrcania and executed. He was paranoid. For what reason? What was he trying to protect? His throne. This is the psycho that the Magi go to and say, hey, the king of the Jews has been born. Awesome. Why would that have been majorly threatening for Herod? Couple reasons.
It's not Jewish.
Number one, yeah, this guy was born as the Jewish king. Herod wasn't. Number two, this guy was the king. And Herod also claimed the same title. In order for Herod to lose that title and this guy to gain his, what would have to happen to Herod and probably his whole family? Executed. Matter of fact, that's why in the next verse it'll say, Herod and all of Jerusalem were a bit disturbed. Yeah, probably. Herod at the end of his life was such a psycho that he had 10 wives, had a lot of offspring. He was worried that one of his sons was going to take over his throne, so he started just killing them off left and right. Herod knew he was such an evil person and nobody liked him, that at his death he had decreed that there would be probably, I think, in the range of a couple hundred to maybe even a couple thousand Jews killed at his death, so that people would be in mourning when he died. He knew how evil he was. He knew nobody would care. They would be rejoicing. He didn't want rejoicing. What ended up happening, though, is that as soon as he died, the decree was overturned. The people weren't killed, and there was great jubilation, which is just awesome. But his legacy was that he was, in Jewish circles and Christian circles alike, the prototypical tyrant that oppressed the people of God. Prototypical. Who were the Magi? What time am I at? Can anybody yell out time for me whenever I... Ooh, 2 minutes! 5 minutes? Is that what you said? I'm going by your clock. Okay. Who were the Magi? I will get your... I'm sorry, you're going to have to ask me after class. I've got to get through a couple of verses. Magi were from the east. Okay, first of all, don't envision we three kings. That is just nowhere in the text. It doesn't make any sense, both practically or even traditionally. The We Three Kings hymn was not written until hundreds of years after this. If they were Magi from the east, and they were traveling about probably 900 miles, it wouldn't be just three of them that went. It would be an entire caravan. Not to mention the fact that these Magi were more than likely people of some sort of royalty. And if they were of some sort of royalty, they would not have traveled lightly. They would have traveled lavishly. So think of a caravan. Don't think of just a couple of people. These people were probably of a priestly group, a kind of hybrid of priest and royalty, from the area of Babylon. Why is that significant theologically? If these Magi were some of the elite, remember in Daniel, his primary rivals in Babylon were who? The astrologers, the magicians, the wise men of Babylon. The irony is this, that the people that were the most honored in Babylon, which took God's kingdom into exile, are now the ones that are coming to herald the king that will bring them into the grand exodus. Isn't that nice? I like it when God does stuff like that. That's just funny to me. Seriously? You're the ones that were in exile under? No, you're going to come and herald the victory of God. They would have been well-versed in astrology, wisdom, magical incantations. That's what they would have been, divination, things like that. And astrology in the ancient world was huge. Very important in the ancient world. There's actually an entire Revelation commentary written by a guy named Bruce Molina that argues that John was just an amazing astrologer, which is what he was seeing in the sky, which is bogus, but... regardless, he's tapping into something. He's tapping into the idea that astrology was very, very, very important in the ancient world. As a matter of fact, the confirmations of emperors, as them being the king, a lot of times, like in Suetonius and Tacitus, were attached to astrological events in the sky. Whether it be some sort of comet or supernova or something like that. And predictions of their destruction oftentimes were attached to stars in the sky. That's just a Roman practice. As a matter of fact, Magi were used to announce the birth of Alexander the Great. You see how this is developing? He's tapping into a tradition of astrology being attached to kings that happened at the time of Jesus' birth. Why did they come to Jerusalem, though, and not Bethlehem? Anybody know? Capital city of the Jews? What else? Hey?
It was like the palace.
Yeah, the temple was there. Matter of fact, that's even where King Herod is ruling from. Logical place for them to go. How much time do I have?
2 minutes.
2 minutes. Yes. Okay, let's go to verse 2. We're going to get through verse 2. We can do this. When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all of Jerusalem with him. We've already talked about why King Herod would be disturbed. Why would all of Jerusalem be disturbed? At the announcement of the King of the Jews has been born. Why would they be disturbed? Yeah! A couple of reasons. Number one, this could be talking about the Jewish elite. All of Jerusalem could be referring as somewhat of a metonymy to the Jewish elite. They would have a big reason to be upset, would they not? Why? Because if the new king comes, what's going to happen to their position of power? Yeah, probably going to lose it. Second, if it was all the kingdom of Jerusalem, you see, Jerusalem, all the empire of Rome, was subject to what was known as the Pax Romana. What does that stand for, the Latin phrase? The peace of Rome. Rome believed that they were the agents of God that had the favor of the gods. And their favor of the gods was shown through the peace that they brought to people because they believed that peace was something that only the divine gods could give to anyone they chose. As a result, if Rome was the one that brought about peace to the entire world, Rome was the key agents of the gods, right? The way in which they enforced the Pax Romana was how? Violent, brutal force. What's ironic about all this is that actually Tacitus says that the Pax Romana is something to be more feared than anything else. The peace of Rome. Whenever there was any sort of riots or uprising, Rome would come and absolutely destroy the city and the people that attempted it, oftentimes crucifying them to make a statement. We are in control. We both give peace and we take it away. Why? Because we are the gods. And if all of Jerusalem is upset, it's probably because they realize if the king of the Jews has been born, there may be an uprising that will meet the Pax Romana face to face, which means devastation not only for the king, but also for their entire city. Make sense? Okay, you guys are dismissed. I love you. We're going to catch up eventually.